Welcome to episode 309 of the Ski Podcast, and thanks for joining us, listener. I am your host, Ian Martin, and today we're going to be visiting La Clusa in France, a resort synonymous with freeride skier Condi Tovex. He brought out his own skis, and we're going to look at the design process behind that range. Plus, we're going to Verbier to find out what it's like to be the first woman to work on the ski patrol there. We also have snow reports from Flen in France, Via Latia in Italy, and St. Anton in Austria. We're going to touch on the class action lawsuit going on in the States and get a Team GB update. And well, that's today's episode. But before we meet today's guests, I'd like to thank Tirol Austria for sponsoring the Ski Podcast and making this winter's episodes possible. If this is your first time listening, you've already missed out on some great conversations about Tirol. We've covered so many great destinations from Innsbruck to Ischgl, San Johann to the ski belt, and you can catch up with all of these, and I recommend you do. It's been really interesting finding out more about the Tirol and the Lebensgefühl, that Austrian way of life that connects them all. Now let's meet today's guests. My first guest joins me for her first time on the podcast. She works on the Verbier Ski Patrol, and we'll be finding out more about that later. Welcome to Victoria Jameson. Hi, Victoria. How are you?
Hello. Good morning, Ian. I'm very well, thank you.
Oh, and whereabouts are you?
I'm in Verbier.
Nice. How's it looking out the window today?
Absolutely beautiful.
As listeners will know, I'm in Chamonix, so not very far away from you as the crow flies. And yeah, it's a beautiful blue sky day. The sun is out. I've just been looking through my binoculars at the mountains and a few people leaving the Grand Moulin hut and ski touring their way up Mont Blanc. My second guest today, I think, is in Verbier as well. He has been on the podcast before. Tony McWilliam is a founder of Faction Skis. Back in 2021, we spoke about what inspired him to start the company and how he built it into one of the most famous freestyle ski brands in the world. Since then, he's continued to design and build snow sport brands, and we'll be finding out more about some of that work today. Hi, Tony. How are you going?
Hi, Ian. I'm very well, thank you. And actually, I've known Vic for a long time, but I feel like there's a lot I don't know about her. So I'm actually really excited to hear a lot about her endeavors.
So I take it you're seeing the same view out of your window when Victoria looked out to her left. You looked to your left as well.
It was over 20 degrees on the slopes yesterday. So it's a beautiful Easter holiday, really.
Yeah, a little bit too warm. It's quite bizarre, really, that maybe 9 days ago, we had fresh snow outside and it was sub-zero temperatures. And I guess this is perhaps a reflection of how things are changing. But I was on the snow only yesterday in La Clusa. I'm going to come to that in due course. But a question I do like to ask my guests is, when did you ski or snowboard last? So, Victoria, when was that for you?
Yesterday, I went on a ski tour. Did my last day on the mountain for the ski patrol on Sunday.
Right. And where did you ski tour yesterday?
I was over behind Les Diablerets and skiing down the Gustad direction. It was fun.
How was the snow?
It's a little warm. It's beautiful, but slightly warm for the season. It was fun.
I also started the day ski touring yesterday in La Clusa on one of the closed areas of Peace over towards Manigo. And it was really interesting to me how many other people were out touring. There were probably like 20 to 30 of us, I guess, just, you know, making our way up those closed pieces. And very kindly, I guess, the snow groomers had driven a snowcat down and created a one snowcat wide track for us to ski back down, which is great. I really appreciated that, because at this time of year, while it is pretty warm and pretty soft spring conditions and slushy in the afternoon, it can still be pretty hard stuff in the morning. And what about yourself, Tony? When were you last on snow?
Yesterday morning with my kids, actually. Got an 8-year-old and a 10-year-old. One of them skis, one of them snowboards. So that was great, just kind of poodling around Verbier. And you're right, it was pretty firm in the morning. And then by mid-afternoon, it was almost what I call Australian conditions, just slush.
You know, there's that sweet spot, isn't there, which I'm thinking at the moment is somewhere sort of around like 11:30 to 12:30 or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, the piece here is still pretty good. You know, you can still ski down into town. Well, on the Verbier side, the Savalier side, not so much. But
cool. Well, I'm actually interested to hear that, because I think next week I'm hoping to come over to Verbier and just sample, you know, what's left of the snow over there before the season comes to a close. And there certainly is skiing around. We have a few snow reports from some of our regular contributors. We've got Simon Burgess, who's been out in Flen. James from Sousy Online is in the Via Latia. And Andy Butterworth from Kaluma Ski is in St. Anton.
Hi, Ian. It's Simon here, reporting from Flen in the Grand Massive. And what a difference a couple of days can make. The Easter period in Flen, like it normally does, has absolutely delivered, with us arriving in resort to kind of 50, 60 centimetres of fresh snow last week and some epic powder turns. But that has soon disappeared, and I'm just currently stood on a red run called Faust, which overlooks the resort, and I'm looking across to my accommodation on a hill that was only a couple days ago covered in snow, and all I can see is green grass and trees. Now, that's actually okay. We don't expect powder turns all the time at Easter, and the last few days in Flen has been absolutely beautiful. The weather is stunning. The ice in the morning before 10 is hard, but that soon softens up and it becomes a really nice skiing environment until about 1 o'clock in the afternoon, after which it is full on spring slush, and those conditions can also be enjoyed. It's worth noting that Marion closed earlier this week, with skiing possible down to 1100 meters there, and the villages of Samoir and Les Corots are soon to join on April the 12th. The latest area open in the Grand Massive will of course be Flen, and I hope that 50, 60 centimetres of snow that was delivered at the start of last week is enough to keep this season rolling on, because the last few days, as I say, have been really enjoyable. Anyway, a shout out to anyone back in the UK, and also anyone who is chasing those last minute turns before the summer comes. And I'll probably be back next season with another snow report, so you'll hear from me then.
Hi, Ian.
Hi, Ian.
James and Sinead here from Southsea Online, reporting from the Via Lattea. It's the last week of the season here, so the lifts close on Sunday the 12th of April in all the Italian resorts. The French resort of Montgenève is still open after that for another week and closes on the 18th of April.
Yeah, we've got fantastic conditions across all the resorts. We are experiencing typical spring conditions though at the moment, with temperatures in double digits, even nudging 20 degrees on the mountain yesterday, which is in stark contrast to the conditions that we had last week. We had sub-zero temperatures, and in fact they were still spraying snow in Southsea and also Santicario, which is the first time I've known them spray snow in March. But it certainly helped keep those lower slopes skiable, which is fantastic.
And we're really enjoying our final week here in the Via Lattea, with sunny, lovely skiing.
Yeah, it's certainly warm. You certainly need your factor 50 on. But as Sinead said earlier, Montgenève is still open for another week, so we've got another week skiing to be had.
So in summary, it's been a fantastic winter season over here in the Via Lattea. Thanks, Ian, so much for having us as regular contributors to the Ski Podcast, and we look forward to seeing you again next winter.
Or indeed, seeing you at the snow show in October.
Cheers, Ian.
Thanks, Ian. Cheers, bye.
Hi, everyone. Andy over in St Anton with probably the last snow report of the season, but what an exciting snow report it is. Happy Easter to all you snow bunnies out there, and let me summarise the last couple of weeks. Since the middle of February, when it last gave the biggest dump everyone can remember of fresh snow over in the Alps, which caused lots of closures and quite a bit of turmoil and trouble, the temperatures changed quite dramatically. So it went really, really warm at the end of February and going into March. By the middle of March, it was summer-like conditions. Certainly spring had sprung very, very early. The flowers were coming out, the birds were chirping, everyone's blaming global warming. Snow was disappearing very, very quickly. The season was as good as over. And then very quickly, how things can change, when the snow gods delivered another huge dump in the last week of March. This wasn't just a great dump, it was an epic dump of soft, fluffy, champagne powder snow. Everyone was back out on the piste. Everyone was skiing waist-deep powder. Everyone had their touring equipment buckled back up again, strapped back on, and hunting out the best snow. But you didn't have to hunt far. The piste weren't as prepared as they always usually are, because there was so much snow. We're talking waist-deep snow just off the sides of the piste, even on some of the piste. It was soft, fluffy, fresh. It was beautiful, beautiful snow. Speaking to lots of the locals and to some of the guides, and it's some of the best snow people can remember skiing in years and years. That was followed by a second big dump, which again kept everybody smiling, and it has definitely stretched out the end of this season, certainly in the Arlberg region. So after probably a week of some of the best snow that many of us have skied ever, temperatures are changing again. It's going warm again. It's going very much like spring. So Easter Sunday feels like spring has sprung again. But the amount of snow that's fallen, it's pushed it at the top way over 2 metres again. Even all the snow down into resort, the pistes are in fantastic condition. They've been moving the snow around to keep everything looking pristine and white. And once again, Easter delivers a massive dump. I always say the best time to ski is Easter, going into April, because the conditions are at their absolute prime. If you've never done your Easter skiing, you really should come and do your Easter skiing. It's cold at night and warm during the days. It's quiet, the pistes are in fantastic condition, the ski touring season is definitely back on, and what a great end to a lovely, lovely season it's been. Cheers, guys, and we hope to see you all on the slopes very soon.
In terms of news, there's been an interesting development on the collective passes story in the States, where a class action lawsuit has been filed against Vail Resorts, who offer the Epic Pass, and Alterra, who offer the Icon Pass. The argument is that those two companies are effectively compelling people to buy their season passes by bumping up the cost of their day passes. Now, I don't propose to cover this in detail today. We might look at it in a future episode. I'm not 100% convinced that argument is going to stand up in court. There is an excellent analysis by Stuart Winchester from the Storm Skiing podcast, and I'll put a link to that in the show notes. Just moving on to Team GB. Even though there were two medals at the Winter Olympics, I know GB Snowsport were disappointed overall, and that's perhaps underlined by the fact that Kirsty Muir, Charlotte Banks and Zoe Atkin all won their overall crystal globes in ski slopestyle, snowboard cross and ski halfpipe, respectively. And what that does show is unbelievable strength and depth that this team has. They've had over 50 podiums across the season. So it was a good Olympics, an exciting Olympics, but those fourth places, I think, possibly hurt overall. Now, regular listeners will know I'm currently based in Chamonix, and one of the great things about being based in the Alps for a while is the chance to visit other resorts as well. I mentioned Verbier, and since we've been here, I've also been to the Three Valleys. I've skied Saint-Gervais, Les Contamines, and this week I visited La Clusaz, and I had a great time skiing around resort and met up with local resident and co-founder of the ski podcast, Jim Duncan, while I was there. I asked him about the ski area and what he likes about it.
It's very exciting to be sitting here in La Clusaz with Jim Duncan, co-founder of the ski podcast, and we've just had a brilliant day's skiing. You showed me around like a proper ski guide. You shared a lot of thoughts with me about La Clusaz. I wondered if you could, I mean, you've lived here for 7 years now, I think. What do you like about La Clusaz? What do you think in terms of the ski area and the big advantages?
So interesting, when I first arrived, we talked about it, I did seasons in Courchevel, Lazark and Teen, right? It's three of the biggest ski areas in the world. And I looked at this piste map and I was like, I'm not sure this is really going to match up for what I want. But genuinely, after 7 years, this is like the best. I love skiing. It's incredible.
Cool. And you told me that you're doing very well. You're getting in like around 100 days a year. So you're getting on the slopes.
Some of my employers might be listening.
Yeah, I'm sure you do all the hours. So you're getting on the slopes a lot. And you have friends coming out as well. And I think La Clusaz ticks a lot of boxes in terms of the skiing it offers.
Oh, 100%. So my friends are coming next week. They booked early on the dynamic passing. So they've got like the lift passes, I think, for £30 for an adult, £20 for a child. That's really good. Down from 54. I don't work for the tourist office. So they've pre-booked, and we'll take them up the Beauregard area, and they'll learn to ski up there, which is a really cool place. But if they hadn't pre-booked, you can literally buy a ticket for £8 return up to this beautiful plateau where there's loads of drag lifts, and really nice place to learn. And there's an old man at the top that will sell you a booklet, and he will stamp it every time you use the drag lift. I think it's like €2 ago.
I love that. It sounds very 1970s, like clipping your card. Yeah. And in Manago, they have a similar system to that? Or it's a good place for beginners to learn?
Manago is a really good place for beginners to learn. But it's part of the La Clusaz pass if you've got a day pass. However, they are allowed to sell their own lift tickets. Online, I think if you buy it beforehand, it's £20 for the whole day. If you actually go on during peak weeks. They do night skiing all the way till 9 p.m. It's the biggest night skiing area in Europe, I'm pretty sure.
Right.
It's really nice. So you could literally ski for £20 for, what's that, 12 hours.
There'd probably be some people who definitely want to do that. And so that's for the beginners and like lower intermediates. But earlier we skied the famous Condé Tovec piste, and possibly we saw him on the slope. Hard to identify people.
It's like a skiing, it's like swimming with dolphins moment.
Yeah, exactly. You've got that whole La Balme area up there, which is much more suited for advanced skiers as part of that La Clusa offering as well.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that La Balme area is, you know, I genuinely think, for me personally, as a fairly competent skier, and you as well, I would say that the pistes are almost pointless up there. Like, it's just such a big, wide, safe free ride zone that you can pretty much on most days of the year go along any track you choose any line you want to ski, and you will have a really good experience.
That's brilliant, Jim, thanks very much.
Now, I have been to La Clusa before, but not for at least a decade. I was particularly keen to go and try their new Black Run, named after hometown hero Condé Tovec. On the off chance, listener, that you have not heard of Condé before, I'm going to suggest you pause the podcast now, go to the show notes and have a look at one of his videos. But I warn you, when I was researching this, I went to his YouTube channel, and about 45 minutes later, I came out. There's just like so much amazing content on there. Now, Condé has said that La Balme, which is the free ride area in La Clusa, has taught him everything and shaped his skiing. So I was really keen to try it. It was pretty slushy, soft snow when we were up there, but it was good fun. And it's unbelievable natural terrain there. It's like a snow park that's been created by nature, I think. And I'm pretty sure we saw Condé while we were there. Small guy with a beanie, going very fast. Tony, I'm guessing you skied over in La Balme.
Yeah, at Faction, we used to do an end of season kind of video. We'd get all the team together. And the first couple of years, we went over to La Clusa and skied in La Balme just to, you know, just because it's, as you say, it's Candide's hometown. It's, as you say, where he kind of learned to ski and where he learned to refine his style. And it's just a great natural terrain area, as you say. It's all kind of there just in one area.
There's so many features there, which, as you say, are just part of the area, natural kickers. I mean, some of them have been, there have been a competition a couple of weeks before with James Woods there, where they created some specific kickers. But just in general, these waves of snow, and they've had a lot of snow there. I think it's easily going to last until towards the end of the season. I was told by locals that it's their best snow for around a decade up there. But late that day, I met with Philippine from the La Clusa tourist office, and I asked her about the links with Condé.
Well, I'm sitting here on the terrace of the Hotel Christiana in gorgeous sunshine and chatting with Philippine Bure from the La Clusa tourist office. Hi, Philippine, how are you?
Hi, fine, and you?
Yeah, I'm very good, because I'm just coming to the end of a magnificent couple of days here in La Clusa. I really enjoyed skiing the area, getting a sense of the village. But yeah, one of the real reasons I wanted to come was I wanted to go and ski that new Black Run, the Condé Tovec run. I wondered if you could just explain Condé's links with La Clusa. I think you said his family are from
his here. His family is from La Clusa since I don't know how many years. The Tovec family is a name from La Clusa. And it was logical for us to have a partnership with Condide. So we did a new line of ski between Condide Tovec and La Clusa. It's only 100 pairs. So
yeah, well, it's interesting.
Limited edition.
It's interesting that you say about the skis. I saw someone with one of those pairs of skis earlier. This is a Condide skis special edition. So this is only for sale through the tourist office. And did you tell me that you only had 100 pairs for sale?
Yeah, 100 pairs, yeah.
Yeah, and the design itself, they're all quite minimalist. This one has that La Clusa ram on it, a stylized ram. And that's the symbol of La Clusa?
Yes, it's a symbol of La Clusa. Since the beginning of La Clusa, I think La Clusa, it's open for the public since 1930. So since 1930, it's the emblem of La Clusa. And there is also, I don't know if you see it, saw it, but it's the little signature of Candide.
Oh, yeah, I did see that. Yeah. So it's a special ski, that one. So look out for it. I also wanted to ask you about some of the developments that are going on in resort. And when I skied in La Balma, I noticed at the bottom there on the, is it called the Colderbaum chairlift?
Yeah.
That's going to be replaced
exactly, for
next season.
Yeah, for a 6 people chairlift and faster than today. Because today is very, very slow.
Yeah, so it'll be a 6-seat detachable chair. But you also mentioned to me earlier, people want to. They can actually buy one of the old chairs.
Yeah. It's going to be on sale, I think, in May. And it's to have a little memories of the Balm chairlifts.
Fantastic. Well, I think, you know, I'd love to do that. Where I put it and how I get it back to Brighton is another matter. There's a couple of other new aspects to the resort as well this year. I think you told me it's only opened a couple of weeks ago, but you've got a new luge here.
Yes, it's the Luge des Bois. Yes, it's brand new and it's sledge on rails and it's for the 4 seasons. So in winter, in spring, in summer, in fall. And it's in La Clusa, it's for people who want to ski, but only not non-skiers people, and it's for everyone.
Yeah, I mean, I've done some of what I think are similar luges in other resorts. A great activity to do with your kids, but also just for adults,
just for you.
As well. And you can fit it in, you know, around your skiing, or if you're here in a summer as well.
Yeah.
Something else I saw up on the slopes as well was the La Bascule.
Yes.
It's kind of like a massive swing.
A giant swing above the mountains and everything. It's included in your ski pass. Yeah, so you can do it whenever you want as many times as you want.
Cool. Okay. Yeah. I must admit, I didn't have enough time to do it this time, so maybe on my next trip. That's fantastic. Really interesting development. Thanks again for inviting me here to La Clusa. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, thank you.
So that was very interesting to hear what La Clusa are doing in respect of the resort and developing some of the lifts there. And listener, you know, you need to pay attention to their website if you want to buy one of those old Colderbaum chair lifts, which are going to be replaced this summer. Now, if you did pause earlier to watch some of Condé's action, and if you're listening to this, you must have come back. The eagle-eyed will have noticed Condé was on faction skis. Tony mentioned that earlier. It segues nicely into our chat. And we covered this in our previous interview, Tony, which I actually republished last summer because I felt that some of the listeners, you know, may not have come across it. But in case listeners haven't heard it, I wondered if you could tell us how you first met Condé.
Sure. I saw him first when I was living in Les Arcs over in France. There was a massive, it was a Quicksilver event that happened at the end of every winter. And Candide was there when he was only 16 or 17, but he blew everyone out of the water. And ever since that, when I started Faction, we kind of had our eye on athletes who kind of represent what we were embodying as a brand. And every time we'd sit down together as a team, we'd kind of say, who do we like? Who do we really feel resonates with our what we're trying to do? And Candide's name kept coming up. And just one year, I was talking to a friend of mine who used to live in Verbier, and he had become an agent for Wasserman, who was the group that Candide was representing. Candide at the time, and he was like, "Well, Candide's just kind of he's come off his last ski brand, and he's looking for assistance, but he's looking for someone who can kind of help him go for the next 10, 15, 20 years into his career." And this was actually quite what people considered quite late. He was, late 20s at the time? He won the World Tour, X Games, etc. And he was at that point where people were kind of thinking that actually it was possibly the end of his career. You know, for a lot of athletes, late 20s is actually, they've kind of peaked and that's it. And we sat down together, we had dinner, and he was doing the few words movie, a 2-year project, which was the story of how he kind of learned to ski and develop his style and build that kind of career. And it was just a really interesting time for us as a brand because we were growing and starting to get an international reputation. And he was looking for someone to kind of come aboard and actually look at how he could develop his own range of products. And we worked quite closely together on that. That was about 2010. So it's actually turned into quite a long partnership.
Absolutely. You know, his videos are incredible. I mean, I guess it's hard to tell whether you know if something's going to go viral. Famously, he'll ski practically anything. He must have crashed a lot of skis. Did that hurt when you see him destroying your skis?
You know what? So on the when he did the Ski the World with, and if you look up that on YouTube, that's great as well. So that's with Audi. He kept calling us up every couple of weeks going, I need more skis. I need more skis. And we're like, what? He must be trashing skis. And we ended up sending him, I think it was 27 pairs of skis over the, it was about 6 to 12 months that he did that project. And at the end of the project, we sat down. I was like, so how many skis did you actually go through? And he's like, oh, one. I'm like, what? One pair. He doesn't trash skis. He skis really lightly and really delicately. And even though you see him skiing overall, like the tough in teen in that last video that he posted, he skis very lightly and he does not trash a lot of skis. I think he just likes the security of knowing that they're there.
But you know, he skied down the Great Wall of China. I mean, that must have ruined them.
Yeah, he literally used one pair of skis in that entire thing.
When just watching those videos, it strikes me that he just must have an unbelievable core. He must be so strong.
Yeah, definitely. I was up at his place last summer, the summer before, and the amount of training he does is phenomenal. Like any athlete, you know, if you're at that level now, it's not what it used to be 15, 20 years ago when we'd all meet in the pub the night before a competition or something like that. You know, it's actually people are pretty serious now.
Well, I can't claim to have ever been at that level. But, you know, since Faction, you've worked on several brands, but you've always kept in contact with Candide. And did that first start when you worked with him on an outerwear brand?
Yeah, so just before I left Faction in end of 2017, Candide had left Quiksilver and was looking to start exploring the opportunities to do his own brand. So I helped design the outerwear line that we put together. And then I left Faction and then we didn't speak for kind of a year or so. And then I got a call and he wanted to actually release all the outerwear line as his own brand. And so that's when we started working together again. I'd done a year or two helping out the Nidecker brothers and Season Equipment, which was Eric Pollard's brand as well. And so when Candide called me, it was kind of an opportunity to kind of complete that circle. At that point, we launched the outerwear line and then we started working on design for his own ski line. And that took about 18 months to 2 years to develop before we released it to the public. I mean, the development of any product is a good 18 months to 24 months. Just the time it takes to design the product from scratch, go through the manufacturing process, prototype, sample. And then what happens is we turn into salesman samples, which go to the market. And then it's a year or 8 to 10 months between when retailers order the product for when it actually comes into store. So it's quite a long development process. We don't just get up one day and go, hey, let's make some skis and put it straight to the market.
Well, anyone who's listened to our equipment episodes with Alan Morgan will know about that really long lead time. He's testing products years before they come to market. I guess there's two elements to a ski. There's the construction and then there's the actual design of the top sheet and the base as well. Just thinking about his new range of skis, that design is very minimalist. I wonder what the thinking was behind that and how that collaborative process with Candide worked.
It's actually quite a funny process because I used to do all the graphics for Faction as well as the physical design. I've got a product design background and a graphic design background. So I do both. And with Candide, he wanted some ideas. So I just came up with 50, 60 different ideas for graphic styles that you could use on the top sheet. And in the end, he kind of sat on them for a couple of weeks and threw them all out the window and went, no, I just want Candide's keys. That's it. And even a really simplistic kind of base motif, which is just die-cut PTEX. And that's it. And actually, the funny thing is, when you're in the lift queue or something, people see these skis which have next to nothing on them, and they actually seem to be more intrigued by that than something with a really, you know, dominant graphic on it, which is hilarious.
For sure, and you mentioned the dyed PTEX on the bases. I kind of figured that, you know, that's the most striking element of the design, and someone who's using Candide skis is going to be often viewed from below, perhaps. Anyway, they're going to make them stand out. I did notice the limited edition La Clusa 101 ski. That has a little bit more design to it. I mentioned it in my interview with Philippine. Was a special element for him?
Yeah, so that was backwards and forwards with the tourist office. And they were looking at ways to incorporate some of the iconography from La Clusa into the ski, but again, Nine Candide, in a very subtle way. So it's really, it's black and white with the little motif kind of above it. But again, simplistic and iconic and recognizable as well. And it's something that'll last.
Well, I actually saw one person with one yesterday, and I think there were only 100 of them made, possibly. Tourist office, you know, are selling them as part of their agreement with Candide. But yeah, they are very special. And what about the construction design of the ski? Can you tell us about the range?
I spent, how long? I think I designed over 150 or 200 skis at Faction. And we went through a lot of different construction techniques over the 15 years or so I was doing that. With the break from Faction to Candide, I had the opportunity to kind of talk to a lot of the factories and look at what was happening in terms of materials and processes. And it's not revolutionary. It's a refinement of the processes that we'd been through in the past. And there were certain kind of developments, like we used this balsa flax core in the past, which lacked a bit of, it had good torsional rigidity, but it lacked compressional strength. So we had some breakages on that. And actually, we ended up using this mix of polonia and poplar, which are a damp, two kind of a lively wood and a damp wood together, which just smooths out everything in terms of ride and feel. And then we mixed fiberglass and carbon, a little bit of carbon in. Too much carbon makes a ski feel horrendous. And we also took the time to refine the shape. A lot of the time when you're working with athletes, they don't really know anything about engineering or construction. They just know what they feel. So you're spending a lot of time interpreting the feedback they're giving you in abstract ways. Like, I landed a little bit backwards and I never land backwards. What does that mean? You know, I translate that into what that means in terms of refining the flex pattern and working with the factory to ensure that it ends up being what the athlete wants and what the athlete feels comfortable skiing on. So it's quite a process.
Yeah. It's a fascinating process being involved in that element of the production design. I know you're working on many projects. What is next for you? Do you have other projects coming up? I kind of have a sense as well that you do a lot of business mentoring. Is that right?
I do. I mentor quite a few kind of smaller brands everywhere, really, US, North America, Europe, Australasia as well, and helping them understand the path that they can follow to actually you grow their business over time, because it's quite challenging understanding what's happening globally. But right now I'm running Forward. So Forward Outdoor, which is a power brand, which I originally started the idea for just before I left Faction. And then I've kind of taken that over a few years after leaving that, and that's my focus right now. So for the next few years, so forwardoutdoor.co.
That's really interesting, Tony. Hopefully that has helped listeners get a little bit of an understanding as to the process that you would go through for creating a new line of skis and some of the thoughts that go into it. If it's okay with you, I'm going to turn to Victoria now, because I think there's a clear segue from Faction's origins in Verbier to her work there today. Now, regular listeners might recall my interview with Angelica Kaufman in episode 270. I spoke to her about her job blasting avalanches in Lech. In that interview, we focused on just one part of the job. But today, I'm really excited to speak to Victoria about her role in the Verbier Ski Patrol. I wondered, is it possible to give listeners a sense for what a normal day's work looks like?
Sure. So a normal day would be a day when it hasn't snowed or it hasn't been windy. And so we'll go up in the morning and meet at Runette, which is at 2,300 meters. There'll be a meeting in the morning, drinking coffee. Maybe there's a cake. Maybe there's some croissants. And we'll discuss what needs to be done.
What sort of time is this that you're all congregating?
So we start at 7:15 in the morning.
Cool. And so you're looking at the day ahead and the different incidents or tasks that you've got to tackle. But I wondered if we could just take you back a little bit. I think I'm right in saying that you were the first woman to join the Verbier Ski Patrol. When was that?
I was in 2008.
So when you first joined, you were the only woman on the team and the only Brit. And we're talking about almost 20 years ago. I wondered if you experienced any or much opposition or what we might call sexism in relation to that?
I wouldn't say it was super easy at the start. It was definitely, I was going into a team of I think at that time there were 29 men and I was one woman. And not only the only foreign person, I think that all the others came from the Val d'Aban, which is where Verbier is. So I was definitely different. I would have to say I was very lucky that I did have a few friends from climbing and mountaineering that were on the team that I knew. That made things easier, but there were definitely a few people that were really not happy to have. I think more than being a foreigner, which was maybe not great, I think it was, yeah, there was definitely a few people that weren't really happy to have a woman on the team at that time.
Well, evidently, almost 20 years later, you've proved them wrong. And I think I did a little bit of research. I was reading that there was a particular incident that happened quite near to where I am right now that started your journey as a ski patroller. I wondered if you would be happy to tell us about that.
Yeah, so I was doing a lot of mountaineering. Well, I still love doing mountaineering. And it was 2003 and we were doing the Traversée des Aiguilles de Chamonix. So it's a two-day, well, some people do it in one day, but it's a two-day traverse of all the Aiguilles of Chamonix, which you're probably looking at right now. And on the first day, it was in 2003, the summer of 2003 was one of the first years that we had that huge heat wave. I had rappelled down and my friend was down climbing and a huge block fell off and crushed his leg and he had to get helied off. And at that time I was just like, wow, I'm doing all this mountaineering and I don't really know what to do in terms of first aid. So it wasn't that I was necessarily looking to become ski patrol, but I really wanted to learn first aid and what to do in emergency situations in the mountains. And so I did that course in 2003, maybe that fall. And then a couple of years later, I got asked to work in Verbier.
So, sorry, what course did you do? Because you make it sound very straightforward, and I'm sure it's not.
So basically, there's three courses over a period of a few years, because not only you have to do the courses, but you need to have a certain amount of experience working before you can do the next course. Yeah, so the first course is it's a two-week course where it's mostly it's focused on medical and snow, and you have an entry test. So you have a ski test. You have to, you know, make sure that you can ski. And then there's a test with the sledge so that they make sure that you can ski down the mountain with the sledge. And then once you pass that test, then you go into this 2 week course where the first week is really concentrated on medical and the second week is really concentrated on everything around avalanche and snow. And then from that, then you have to work a whole year or 2 years, I don't remember. And then you go on to the second course, which is called the B. And that is all concentrated around avalanching and bombing. And that's where you get your bombing permit, basically.
I love that concept, to be given a bombing permit. You know, when I spoke to Angelica, you know, that does sound quite, I don't know, thrilling to me. I mean, evidently there's danger to it as well. But what you're doing is you're making the area safe. In fact, it might be interesting to talk about that. I mean, this winter we've had several really intense snowfalls with huge accumulations over short periods of time. And I think many listeners, they'll have heard blasting. And they'll have probably perhaps waited, frustrated, waiting for the lifts to open. I thought it might be useful if you could explain why that delay is so important.
First of all, I mean, there's all this, you know, we go up in the morning and then we have to discuss, because there's a lot of, it's because of the wind, how much it snowed, et cetera, et cetera. And so then our boss puts us into teams in terms of who's going to bomb where. All the bombs are actually kept in a bunker underneath the mountains, and that's like 10 different keys to get in. It's Fort Knox. You know, it's a lot of organization going in, getting to the bunker. This year we had we experienced where even to get to the bunker was not easy because there's snow above and we were worried that it was going to slide to get in before even getting into the bunker. And then there's all the helicopter bombing, that's also having to go into the bunker, getting the bombs out, putting the fuses into the bombs, getting them ready, and then going up into the mountain. Because a lot of it, I don't think people know, some of it is obviously done by helicopter when it's good weather, but a lot of it's done by foot or by skis. So, I mean, that obviously takes time.
The bombs that you're talking about, what kind of size and format are they? I think, you know, most people kind of imagine a stick of dynamite, but it's not quite like that, right?
It's 1.5 kilos are the bombs that we throw by hand. And it's actually nitroglycerin, like a paste. Yeah, so it's like a big sausage, a 1.5 kilo sausage that we then put two fuses into. And then we literally, we light the fuses and then we throw them. The fuses are 1.5 minutes before it explodes.
Okay. I mean, I love that echo in the morning on after a heavy snowfall when you hear the blasting going on. But I think it's quite interesting to bring that down to the individuals who are doing it. You know, thinking about someone, because you've gone up there, the lift system isn't open, but it must have been open to get you to the top of the slopes or get you into the right zones to be able to throw these bombs in the right places.
Yeah, and sometimes, I mean, on really big snowfall days, it's not even possible to run certain lifts because they've been iced up or there's too much snow underneath the platform. So we have to go up on the rat tracks. Yeah, so it's just a whole lot of organization before that. And often when we're doing it by foot, yeah, we don't really see much. It's super windy. It's super whiteout conditions. So you're often on ridges because that's the safest place to be. But yeah, you really have to watch out where you're going. There's often cornices on one side. You don't want to fall onto off the cornice, etc.
I'm sure you don't. What about the helicopter then? Do you sometimes go up in that? And is that a different skill, or is it that just like dropping it over the side, is it?
So they use 2.5 kilo Tovex, it's called, which is actually funny, talking about Candid. That's the name of the bomb, Tovex. So that's always our boss that does that. The two head of the ski patrol are the ones that do the bombing from the helicopter. They have an electric allumage. It's not a real flame for safety reasons.
That, I can see how that would make sense. So to me, that sounds fascinating and certainly be the part of the job that I imagine I would enjoy the most. But what are the favorite parts of the job to you?
No, that definitely has to be one of the favorite parts. It's incredible. Although it can be scary and it's dangerous, it's super exciting. Yeah, the most amazing part is definitely the early mornings, just going up there, you're a toy by yourself. The sunrises are just incredible. Getting to ski the mountain before anyone's there, that definitely is really cool.
And maybe sometimes you see some of the local fauna that other people wouldn't spot.
Yeah, I've yet to see a wolf, but I've seen the wolf tracks in the morning. So that's pretty cool.
Excellent. Well, that's brilliant, Victoria. Thanks for sharing that. Must have been fascinating joining the ski patrol, breaking down the barriers like that and learning those skills. And I think I can speak on behalf of all skiers to yourself, but all ski patrollers, to thank you for the work that you're doing, keeping people safe.
I just wanted to say that now there's 5 ski patrol girls. So I think that's really pretty cool.
Excellent. Well, that is another example of how things perhaps have progressed since then. Well, I am hoping to visit Verbier before the resort closes. So maybe I'll see you or Tony on those slopes. We're just going to move towards the end of this episode now. If you've enjoyed this episode, or even if you didn't like it, I would love to know. You can leave a comment on Spotify, Instagram, or Facebook. Our handle is @SkiPodcast, or drop me an email, theskipodcast@gmail.com. Look in the show notes for the link to our WhatsApp channel, where you can find exclusive material released ahead of the podcast. We've had a bit of feedback since the last episode. Andrew Dixon said, great interview with Tim Wall. That was episode 299. I love the Ski Lodge and all the bands that have played there over the years. We'll be back for our 21st visit next year. He also mentioned he's played for one of those après ski bands, Bring Your Sisters. James Rice said, I've just downloaded episode 308 about Chamonix. Really looking forward to this one. Hope you enjoyed it, James. And Sean Burton said, I wanted to reiterate how much I enjoy the podcast. So I discovered it after my first ski trip in January 2024, and I've been listening avidly ever since. He goes on to say about his recent train trip to Landek, where he stayed for 4 nights, taking the ski safari transfer to Ishkel each day. He then continued on training to the Dolomites. All in all, he says, a fantastic trip. So thanks again for the inspiration and practical insights from the podcast. There are now 309 episodes of the Ski Podcast to catch up with. Around half of them, 153, were listened to in the last week. If you'd like to get some insight on a particular destination or the latest kit, just go to skipodcast.com, have a search around the tags and categories, and you're bound to find something of interest to you. I can also tell you in the last week, around half of our listeners were in the UK, 15% in the States, and everyone else listening as far and wide as Brazil, India, and the Philippines. So that is it for this week. I will be back in 2 weeks' time when I'll be reporting from a unique triathlon in Courchevel. We'll find out about the resorts of Risoul and Var in France. And I'm really looking forward to this. We'll be exploring the inner skier and how anxious skiers can fall back in love with skiing. In the meantime, please do subscribe. If you do that, helps other people find us. Plus, if you enjoy the podcast, you can always buy me a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/ski podcast. On that note, I would like to do a shout out to listeners Sasha and Jeremy for buying me a coffee in real life. Both worked out that they would be in Chamonix at the same time as me, and I managed to meet up with them at different points, with Sasha before and after his epic Haute Route experience, and with Jeremy in La Tour. Thanks so much, guys. I really appreciate it. I enjoyed meeting you. So much of the time, it's just me talking. And I know the stats say there are thousands of people listening, but it's always good to meet people in real life. Right. For now, I'd like to thank my guest today, Victoria. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ian.
And Tony, thank you.
Thanks, Ian. Lovely to talk to you again.
I would like to thank Tyrol for sponsoring the podcast. And finally, listener, thank you for joining us wherever in the world you're listening right now. And until next time, goodbye.